John Daly here. You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spin on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily, and the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto, America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. It is the fall of 1962. John Kennedy is the president, and the meetings in the White House over these last days have been in a crisis mode. We know it now as the Cuban Missile Crisis. However, it has lessons in it that here all these decades later we can review because of the concern that we're in a new Cold War, Cold War 2.0, and review because we're not in the same predicament. There's a third player on the field, the People's Republic of China. I learned this again and again with lessons learned and things to know from a new book by Michael McFaul, the distinguished professor who is the director of the Freeman Spogli Institute on the Stanford campus, also at the Hoover Institution. The book is Autocrats versus Democrats, China, Russia, America, and the New Global Disorder. Michael, a very good evening to you. Thank you, Professor, for joining. Immediately to October, November 1962, Jack Kennedy is faced with information that the Soviets under Nikita Khrushchev have placed medium-range missiles with the possibility of delivering nuclear weapon warheads into Cuba, and what is to be done. That was a crisis at the time that you and your reporting correctly identify as one of the worst, if not the worst, moment in the Cold War. What did we learn then? What do we know now about that confrontation that helps us here in the 21st century? Good evening, Professor.
Well, good evening, and thanks for having me, John. Good to see you again. I think it's a great place to start because it was, in my view, one of the most dangerous, probably the most dangerous moment in the Cold War. And obviously, we still call it the Cold War historically because it didn't become a hot war between the United States and the Soviet Union, even though they did fight from time to time proxy wars. But that was a major crisis because, it involved nuclear weapons. And the use of nuclear weapons means complete obliteration of both countries involved, and lots of other countries would be affected by it. And when I looked again at it, I'd studied the Cuban Missile Crisis before I taught it. But when I went back and looked at that period again for this book, one thing that was very striking to me was how bad our communications were, how we were making guesses about the intentions of the other side, both in Moscow and Washington. And rightfully so, after that, both governments learned to set up crisis management mechanisms, crisis prevention, symbolized by this red phone, you know, the hotline, so that there could be direct communication. But that was just a symbol for a lot of things that happened afterwards, to try to get to know each other better. Arms control ensued after that, and it didn't slow down the number of arms, but we learned about each other's nuclear arsenals. And through that learning process, that was a stabilizing process. And I think that's a very important lesson for dealing with both Russia and China, but especially China today. You know, when I was the U.S. ambassador in Moscow, I used to always say to my team, we're going to have a lot of conflicts and disagreements with Putin today. He came back as president in 2012, right when I became the U.S. ambassador. But we can never have a disagreement with this government based on bad information or an incorrect reading of their intentions. And when I look at U.S.-China relations especially, because that's the most dangerous in the long term, in my view, the connectivity that we have is just not what it was during the Cold War. And I think that is an important lesson that we should get back to. It doesn't mean we're going to agree with them. It doesn't mean by having meetings with them that we legitimate their regime. Nobody should make any of those mistakes. But crisis management and crisis prevention is something we learned out of the Cold War, and something I think we need to do again in dealing with China and Russia today.
At that moment, 1962, it is assumed by those of us who are young people, I was certainly a teenager, that the world was looking to the United States and the President of the United States for leadership in the face of the dictatorship of Russia and its allies. And Russia did have a few allies, although they were all under the Soviet boot at the time.
Yes.
Eastern Europe. So that 1962 represents the golden years of the democracy. The reason I bring this up is that Michael asks a very good question at the beginning of his book. How did we go from euphoria about democracy and globalization, that would be 1962, and the West, three decades ago, and how did we go to uncertainty about democracy, doubt about liberal international disorder, and fear of powerful autocracies today? In other words, everything was ours, including the well wishes of the world in 1962. Here we are in the middle of the third decade of the 21st century, and there's nothing but doubt all around us. It's a really good question, Michael. So I want to go one more time at that moment in 1962. China was not on the field.
Right.
China was a broken country, and it was very difficult to see, I think. There was no transparency. However, it was ruled autocratically by Mao Zedong and his lieutenants. Can we regard that those autocrats, along with Vladimir Putin, as threatening the United States, even though we couldn't see it at the time? Were they a threat as well?
They were, and I'm glad you brought that up, because if you were measuring power with metrics that we use to measure power, the PRC under Mao was not a powerful country. You're absolutely right about that. But what they were, they had a leader with a lot of intentionality. So it's will and way, right? He didn't have the same capabilities as the Soviet Union. But I would argue that he was a much more revolutionary, revisionist leader than most certainly Khrushchev and Brezhnev were. You know, go back a decade before 1962. You know, they barely had a country. They had a civil war for a long time. They seized power as a communist dictatorship in 1949. And the next year, literally the next year, they fight us in Korea. And I think there's a parallel there, thinking about Putin's Russia versus communist China today. So Putin's Russia today is not as powerful as China by all metrics. And yet, because Putin has this will of revisionism, I would call it imperialism, he's using his limited capabilities actually in more destabilizing ways than the Chinese are today. And I think that comparison between the Soviet Union back in the 50s and 60s, more power, but not as crazy. Let's just be, as Mao was, to take on. I mean, we had a hot war with the Chinese communists on the Korean Peninsula. And that was because that his ideas and his leadership pushed us in that way. And that sometimes gets not as much as attention in academia and in foreign policy making as I think it should.
Also important, Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin were also young men at the time. They were schoolboys. Mm. However, they were absorbing the lessons of their country. Xi, because what we were looking at is the early days of the Cultural Revolution, which was a nightmare. And his father was repressed, though his father was a Princeton member of the leadership in the Communist Party. And Putin was outside the circle of everything, except for he bore with him the resentment of what had happened to Russia during the Second War. That's their childhood. We go now
Yes.
to a good incident that happens later with China. These are promising moments, but they're critical moments as well to help me understand Autocrats versus Democrats, China, Russia, America, and the New Global Disorder by Michael McFaul. Next, Tiananmen Square. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor with my colleague Michael McFaul, former ambassador to the Soviet, now Russian Federation, as well as a professor at Stanford University and the director of the Freeman Spogli Institute on the Stanford campus. But most important for me right now is the author of a new book, which is not even slightly long enough because he has Tehran and North Korea and all these other players to bring on, but he's kept it to Russia and China. So we're doing some backstory here to understand the opportunity and the challenge of the 21st century. Tiananmen Square, June 1989. There's a lot of detail here, but it comes to the fact that on camera we saw the Chinese Communist Party direct its army to be cruel and violent and murderous. The opportunity at that point was that the Soviet Union was deeply troubled and would fall apart while Michael was there in 90 and 91. The Chinese Communist Party thought it too was vulnerable to such a uprising from the bottom, and they crushed those students. George H.W. Bush was the president, and he made a decision. The decision was to reach out with an open hand. Why did he do that, and what did we learn from it, Michael?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it was a tragic moment in American foreign policy history. I understand it, and the argument for doing that by the Bush administration is that we needed the Chinese to balance against the Soviet Union. That was started by Nixon and Kissinger, and the idea we helped to pull them away. Now, the split, I want to emphasize, the split between the Soviets and the Chinese communists happened well before then. We didn't cause it. And I think there's some misunderstanding of that in terms of people dreaming about peeling the Russians away from the Chinese today. But that was the theory of the case. That's why we needed them. And that was the opening, you know, in terms of economic engagement that was happening during that period. I just think they could have handled it a little differently. I don't, at that point, 1989, you know, nobody had to worry about the Soviet Union. As you just said, they were in a period of retreat and later collapse just 2 years later. I think one should, you know, I liked actually the way that President Reagan talked about dealing with autocrats. And I think it would have been a better formula here. And it's all in George Shultz's memoirs. He was a mentor of mine here at the Hoover Institution. He wrote the best memoir ever about diplomacy. It's really long, so maybe that's why people haven't read it. But he speaks very explicitly in that book about the need to engage with dictators. And remember, Shultz came in 1982, 2 years after President Reagan had won the election, when there was hardly any conversation with the Soviets. And he comes in and says, well, we got to talk to these people because we have issues with them, particularly about nuclear weapons. But he's made it very explicit, and he was well known for this, is that when we're talking to them, we're not going to check our values at the door, and we're not going to let them dictate what the agenda is. And so George, when he would meet with his Soviet counterparts, and I presume Chinese counterparts, but I know the story about the Soviet Union better, he would talk about nuclear weapons and things they wanted to talk about, but then he also brought up human rights. He also brought up, for instance, opening a consulate in Ukraine because he wanted more connectivity with people in Ukraine. And I just think that dual track diplomacy that we talk about security things, but values, I think that would have been a better way to approach it. Doesn't mean we were going to help democratize China in 1989. I'm not naive enough to believe that. But looking away, I think, did damage to our reputation at the time.
The conversation initially was between representative of the president. That would be Brent Scowcroft, the lieutenant general. I believe Mr. Yes. Eagleburger was with him. They had a conversation in the summertime and again in the winter, I believe, December, near to at the end of the year. And Deng Xiaoping, the big boss at the time, made a compromise as well. He committed himself to a form of capitalism. Was that an opportunity for us? Did we take that opportunity to build more institutions of democracy into China, or did we do hands off? We're just gonna worry about the China price.
Again, it's a complicated, great question. And John, you really know your history. I am deeply impressed. The many of the references you're making are not in my book, just so everybody knows. My original book, by the way, was 1,200 pages
Yes,
long.
I know, Michael.
Because I had to, my editor made me get it down to 500.
I know, and I often felt, well, let's keep going here, Michael.
Yeah, maybe another time, another
you
book.
You did speak of Tiananmen, though. You gave me an opening.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Tiananmen's in the book. But you're asking one of the most fundamental questions about the nature of our relationship with China and Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union. He did make those concessions, and he did open up the Chinese economy to the West, including the United States. And let's be clear, American companies made billions and billions and billions of dollars and continue to do so because of that opening. And that was good for American capitalism, and it was good for Chinese economic growth. You know, 4 decades of growth, unprecedented in world history. There was a theory, and I don't know if people really believed it. I hesitate, right? Because I was not around working in the government. But most certainly our leaders were saying economic growth and economic modernization will eventually create the permissive conditions for democratization. The Bush presidents talked that way. Bill Clinton talked that way. And I don't know if they really believed it or not, but it didn't work. It didn't work out that way. And today, China is one of the most successful economies in the world, the most successful economy in the world, I would argue, that is ruled by a communist dictatorship. I took out the word communist because actually, with regard to the economy, it's a mixed system these days. And that part we got wrong. Now, whether we did that intentionally or we just wanted to look the other way so our companies could make profits, that part I do not know the answer to.
The challenge here is to understand that moment in time. So when it comes the next time, we'll have a background story. And
yes,
one more detail here. The alternative looked at the time, looking at the headlines, to be chaos in China.
Yes.
Danger to the billion citizens and to the whole region. When we have that choice again, and we had it in 1991 when you were in Moscow, and we're going there now, it was the same challenge. And it'll come again, Michael. Did we learn anything? We have about a minute. Did we learn anything about that choice? We chose peace in both instances.
Well, we chose peace. That was the right choice in both places. And chaos and breakdown is not in our national interest, especially when you're dealing with a country like the Soviet Union with nuclear weapons. But I think in retrospect, we were too complacent. Yeah. We thought the whole world wanted to be democracy and we didn't have to do anything about it. I think had we leaned in more in the early 90s, especially with political assistance that they wanted and economic assistance as they went through a depression, we might have helped consolidated that regime like we did after World War II with Germany, Japan, and Italy.
Let's go to Moscow with Michael McFaul at the time. He's now a professor at Stanford University, the author of Autocrats versus Democrats. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, speaking with Professor Michael McFaul, former ambassador to the, at one time, Russian Federation, at one time, the Soviet Union. They're both Russia. So I can slip in my language because I'm a little older and I grew up under the Soviet version of Russia.
Right.
We now have the Russian, we now have the Federation version of Russia. It's 1990-91. And a young graduate student named Michael McFaul is in Moscow while the whole world is watching an experiment by a man named Mikhail Gorbachev, who inherits the big boss role of the Soviet Communist Party because of the deaths of 3 very aged and very unchanging men. They're gone. Gorbachev is in charge, and he's got ideas, glasnost and perestroika. That translates into reaching out to the United States. There's a background to this, and before we plunge into what happened in Moscow in 1990-91, Michael, détente, 1972, Richard Nixon and Leonid Brezhnev. Is that now considered a success when you reflect upon dealing with autocrats?
That's a great question. I think it's a very contested debate in my world. Some people blame that period for prolonging the Soviet Union. I don't. I think it was a successful policy for the at the time to advance American national interests. And I always like to emphasize that your job when you work for the United States of America in the U.S. government is to advance our national interest, our security, our prosperity, our values, not other countries. And I think that was a wise strategy at the time. I think there's some lessons from that period for how to deal with the Chinese today. Maybe we went a little too far, in my view, in not speaking about human rights issues during that period. That was kind of off the table. I think you can do both. I kind of like the way the Reagan folks did it later. But I think it was a useful time in stabilizing relations between two superpowers and lessening the probability of a war between two nuclear powers.
The joke I've always enjoyed at the moment, there's so many, is when Brezhnev gives a tour of his cars, that some of the vehicles came from Richard Nixon as presidents to Brezhnev, who loved to drive them. Showed them to his mother at the Kremlin. This is a joke. And she watched him be so proud of his Cadillac, and she started to weep, and he said, "Mama, mama, why are you weeping?" She said, "Oh, Leonid, what if the Reds come back?" And so that was the temperament of 1972. We now
Yes.
go to 1990, 91, when you were there. This is dealing with a country that's crumbling all around you. Did you see the end of the Soviet Union coming? Could you feel it in the streets of Moscow, Michael?
Yes, I did. In fact, I wrote a piece in the summer of 1990 in the San Jose Mercury News because I was a young guy and I couldn't get it published at other places. But it compared the French Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution, to what I was calling the Soviet Revolution at the time. This is a year before, year and a half before the collapse. Because I saw these patterns. This book by Crane Britton called Anatomy of Revolution had a big impact on me at the time. And I was seeing the phases. And the initial phase of reform under Gorbachev, I predicted was going to lead to a more radical phase. And then the Jacobins would come in, and they did. That's the Yeltsin era. And then there would be a counter-revolution, as there oftentimes is, the Thermidor, as we called it in the French Revolution. I didn't know the name of the person, but in France it was Napoleon, in the Bolshevik Revolution it was Stalin, and in the Russian Revolution it turned out to be Vladimir Putin. But in 1990, 91, I knew this. It felt like a revolutionary moment for me. But we don't know how revolutions end, right? The collapse of the old order, the Ancien Regime, is not doesn't mean we know how to predict what happens later. And it felt so much that way that I wrote a book. I didn't, it's not a book, actually. It's a Hoover publication, which was a series of interviews, John, where I interviewed all the leaders from the liberals to the communists to the nationalists to the fascists, because I wanted to capture that moment in history that in the archives so that when people go and study what happened, they would feel that moment of uncertainty as I did back in 1990, 91.
Did you feel personally at risk when you learned of the coup attempt that summer against Gorbachev? Americans, were they warned to start packing?
Well, I left in June of 1991 and then came back in October of 1991. So I was not there for the 3 days of the coup, but I'll tell you, as I was driving out my last meeting with my academic advisor, Moscow State University, Apollon Davidson is his name. And he was an African specialist because I was there doing research on my dissertation, but I got pulled in to working with the small D Democrats, and I make no apologies for that. It was a very exciting time. And as I was going to the airport, literally that day, I said, "I'll see you in the fall," because I'd planned to come back. And he said, "Mr. McFaul, you'll never be let back in this country." And I was shocked when he said that. And he said, "We know what you've been doing here. We know you've been working with these other people. And we, our side, that the KGB side," he alluded to, "we are taking over and we're not going to allow people like you ever to come back." And I remember thinking, that was a very sobering conversation. His people did try to take over in August 1991, But they were thwarted. They were thwarted by the small D Democrats. His side lost. And in this round, my side won.
Now we come to that same moment that the U.S. makes a choice, because the Soviet Union ends at the end of that year. Yeltsin becomes the new chief in charge of the whole of the country, although it's not clear what the whole country is. The Soviet right. Empire is breaking into pieces. The money's no good. I know because I've talked to men in Azerbaijan who were there at that moment in Baku. They had no reserves. They had nothing. They had nothing forward. They didn't know what to do with their oil. It was that way across the country. But Yeltsin takes charge. And again, it's a moment where the U.S. and her allies have choices to make. Do we send a military in, or do we send diplomats in? We chose diplomats again. Was it the right choice, Michael?
Yes, it was definitely the right choice. It was definitely the right choice to engage with Yeltsin, as President Bush did and then Clinton did afterwards. They didn't write it away. You know, President H.W. Bush held on to Gorbachev because he was somebody we knew well, and we feared the collapse of the Soviet Union because there were nuclear weapons in other parts of the Soviet Union at the time. We feared that at the time. But once it happened, he made the right decision to lean in, engage, support Yeltsin as a Democrat. I think the mistake we made, Democrats and Republicans both in the United States, is we just thought it was going to, you know, they were going to become Democratic and that it was the end of history, as my colleague here at Stanford, Frank Fukuyama, wrote very famously at the time. So we didn't invest into trying to make that happen. We just thought it was going to happen organically. Very different from what we did in World War II when we, you know, we occupied Germany, we occupied Japan to help them build their democratic institutions. But because the reason we did that in 45 and we didn't in 91, 92 is because in 45 there was a lingering threat called the Soviet Union. And we knew that if we let these collapsed states on their own, they would be taken over by the communists. There wasn't that lingering threat to the East in 1991, 92. Had there been, had China been as powerful today as they back then as they are today, maybe we would have done more. But as a result, I think we were just too complacent. And I think had we put more effort in on both the political and economic side, we might have had different outcomes.
You write again and again, you're a liberal internationalist. I wasn't certain what that was before, but having now read your book, I am too, Michael. I confess it. Okay. So.
A bad term, though. We've got to get better terminology. Yes.
Okay. I'm McFaulite. Okay. Here we go. All right. Bill Clinton's campaigning for the presidency in 92. He's successful. However, he makes remarks, repeated remarks in those early days, that we have to look to our own domestic concerns and that the world now has a peace dividend. Was that the wrong direction at the time? Because it felt very logical given the campaign needs. Was there more that could have been done during that campaign between H.W. Bush, who was running for re-election, and Bill Clinton to be clear that we were going to do more for Russia? I know it's 2020 hindsight, but you were there, Michael.
Yeah, that was a critical year. That was the first year of independence for Russia and Ukraine and Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan. All those countries were newly independent. And because the governor of Arkansas, his main slogan in 1992 was, "It's the economy, stupid," that constrained what President Bush was prepared to do to help consolidate those democracies and those market economies. And there's just no doubt about it that the timing of that event, that 92 election and the first year of independence in Russia was detrimental to consolidating the regime and the economy, the capitalist economy. Now, once President Clinton wins the election and is in power in 1993 as president, he gets this. He makes some big speeches about how we are in alliance with the ideas of democracy inside Russia. But by that time, it was too late. By the time he became president, the liberal reformist government led by Yegor Gaidar in 1992. And when I use the word liberal, I mean it in the classic sense. These are people that believed in freedom and democracy. They also believed in capitalism. They would have been very comfortable working as senior research scholars at the Hoover Institution. But they were already thrown out. They were already gone by the time 1993 came along. So that turned out to be a missed year that was, I think, rather consequential in terms of the history of Russia and U.S.-Russia relations.
One more detail, because you were there. You went back to Russia as a representative of people interested in talking about democracy all the time. And you had a ready-made audience. That audience, was it at that point empowered, or was it academics?
No, it was the government. It was 1992. I worked for something called the National Democratic Institute, which is one of the affiliates of something called the National Endowment for Democracy that Ronald Reagan established when he was president. And we were working directly with the author of the Constitution. We were, literally providing constitutional experts to talk about the pluses and minuses of a presidential system versus parliamentary, proportional representation as an electoral system versus the American system of first past the post. We worked with a lot of governors. There was such a demand for information. In fact, one of our most popular publications, John, was called How to Win Elections. It was a 6-volume study that we put out for politicians. And NDI, the group I work for, we were affiliated with the Democratic Party, but our brochure was actually from the Republican Party, extremely popular. And I think I'm glad you asked that question, because we weren't there to foment revolution. We were invited by the Yeltsin government because they wanted to learn about democratic institutions at the time.
Michael McFaul is the author of Autocrats, Russia and China versus Democrats, the U.S. and its allies, and The New Global Disorder. We turn now to the People's Republic of China. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor with Michael McFaul, professor at Stanford University. He's at the Hoover Institution, and he's the director of the Freeman Spogli Institute. But the book now that I recommend highly to understand how we got into this fix in the third decade is Autocrats versus Democrats. Competition between the U.S., China, and Russia, the three-body problem. It makes a great story, but we don't know how it comes out. So I want to establish, Michael, that Deng makes that transition into capitalism. Yep. By the time that we're now dealing with, the 21st century, China's getting richer and richer and likes it, but it has a lot of details. Inside that richer and richer is resentment for at least a century, if not more.
Yes.
And that resentment, is it something you've experienced? Because you've traveled in China before and after Xi. Was it always there, or does Xi magnify it?
Well, that's a great question. It's called the century of humiliation in Chinese history books. And I think we in the West, and most certainly me, even when I began researching this book, did not understand the full magnitude of it, where we, the Western powers, the imperial powers came in and occupied territory, and the Japanese really came in, obviously, during World War II. But it was a time of weakness for China. And remember, this is a country that's been around for many, many centuries, has dominated Asia for many, many centuries. But the 19th century and the early 20th century was a time of extreme weakness that resulted in millions of people dying in World War II. And so when the Communist Party takes over in 49, and they do through force, right? It wasn't a free and fair election. They do so by force. They pledge to never allow China to be as weak again. And I think when you look at Xi Jinping today, that century of humiliation weighs on his mind. He does not want China to be in a weak spot. By the way, I don't think they are anymore. I never personally, that's a great question. I never personally experienced it. I have always been struck by, in my travels to China, and I spent a couple summers there during the writing of this book, never felt that directed towards me personally, but directed towards the West, most certainly. And they want to be strong enough that it'll never happen again.
The concern that I have is to explain right now Xi Jinping's extreme attention to maintaining order in his own state, so much so that he said to contribute to the contraction of the economy. Was that always there? Was it there from Deng in the beginning? We just didn't see it because of all the successes, the keenness on controlling people, on dominating their lives.
So yes and no, and it's a very complicated question. But I'm glad earlier in our conversation, we were talking about Tiananmen Square in 1989, and there was a period in the 70s and 1976 and the democracy wall. There was this period in China that I think gets forgotten in America today, that there was pluralism, that there was a demand for democracy, and it was real. They had to squelch it on June 4th, 1989, but it didn't go away in 89. I think that's another mythology, that it was bubbling along and there was opening and there were, pluralism and non-governmental organizations after Tiananmen Square. It didn't all end at that time. And that political opening created permissive conditions for the economic opening. They were intertwined, and there's some really great books that I read. Min Xin Pei is one of them that writes about that opening of political opening allowed for economic opening. But what you see in China today under Xi Jinping is an erosion of both. So he is much more autocratic, in my view, than the previous three leaders of China, much more controlling. By the way, technology helps that. So that, you know, all the kind of monitoring technologies that you have available today that leaders like did not have before, he uses those. And second, as you hinted at, China grew economically because they became more like us. They opened up their markets. They became, you know, market ideas were allowed. Xi Jinping is now moving away from that. And I think that is going to slow economic growth. They did not grow because of Communist Party ideas. They grew because of market ideas. And as he reintroduces more state control of the economy, I think it's going to slow down Chinese economic growth.
The concern is that China is a dynamic culture and that there are many challenges to Xi's strength and his concentration of power in his hands. Do we have the same concern? We have 30 seconds. If he goes, chaos?
We should definitely worry about chaos because it's a multi-ethnic society. It's an imperial reach to the hinterlands, and people are repressed and they want to be free. People in Hong Kong want to be free. The Uyghurs want to be free. But I think that a peaceful process is still more likely than chaos.
We turn to autocrats versus democrats in the 21st century. Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping. China, Russia, America, and the new global disorder. Michael McFaul. I'm John Batchelor.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made, because that's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21+.
Moto Casino.